This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
1,293 points. What a difference a weekend and some implied promises from central banks can make. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Monday, today, the 2nd of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. So look, we should be clear here, right? Nothing has changed for the better coronavirus-wise since last we spoke on Friday. In fact, there have been fatalities in this country. There is more testing being done, so there are more reported cases. And conferences and companies are canceling travel and meetings by the day. But some big central banks, Japan, the European Central Bank, and the U.S. Fed in particular, have all come out and said, in essence, we got it. We're watching. We're ready. And if push comes to shove, we will jump in to keep things from getting too terribly much worse. And that, in a nutshell, is what you need to know about the markets today. The major indices up 4, 5%, reclaiming a chunk of what they lost last week. But the macroeconomic reality, which, in case I need to remind you, is not the stock market, is still kind of up in the air, both here and globally. In China, where we have gotten Marketplace's Jennifer Pack on the phone, things are only just now getting back to normal, and barely at that. Some big economic numbers came out to the downside over the weekend. Hey, Jennifer.
Hey, Kai.
So, first of all, I guess, what's the mood? What's it like in Shanghai today?
Well, life is slowly coming back to the streets of Shanghai. You see a lot more people, a lot more cars, a lot of bikes. And at restaurants, you do see a lot more of them offering sit-down dining services, but only if you could sit very far away from each other. And there are some restaurants, the last order is still at 6:30. If you come out at about 8 p.m., sometimes 10 p.m., you'd think it's midnight or overnight, you know, because the streets are pretty empty. So if you go anywhere now in public spaces, you essentially everyone is required to wear a face mask, which are very uncomfortable to wear. It's hard to breathe. And of course, there's a shortage of them. So for all intents and purposes, people are still pretty much forced to stay at home, which is the last place you can breathe freely.
Right. And so I guess the corollary question is, what's the mood like, given all those restrictions and given the way you have to sit far away from people in restaurants? I mean, what's the mood? What are people thinking?
I think there's a lot of anxiety still. You know, people are pretty fearful. And there's still a lot of unknowns about how this virus is being spread out. So people are very cautious. And, you know, almost every day we're being bombarded with text messages from the government saying, cancel your social gatherings, stay at home, wear a mask if you have to go outside, eat apart from your colleagues, you know, sit in separate desks. It makes people very paranoid. And so there's only a handful of people that I've seen over the last month who are willing to come out and take the risk.
All right. So to the economic nuts and bolts then, the manufacturing and service sector numbers that came out late Friday U.S. time over the weekend for you, they were not great, both in non-manufacturing and also in manufacturing, actually getting things made.
Yeah, they're not great. They both fell below 50, which shows a contraction. But for businesses, especially for January and February, these are really slow months because of the Lunar New Year holiday. Mm-hmm. And because there are close to 300 million workers working hundreds of miles away from their hometowns, some of them take extended holidays. So for all intents and purposes, March is when companies really have to make their quarter one targets. And so this is going to be the crucial month. And the key question for a lot of these businesses is whether they can resume their operations. And at the moment, a lot of businesses say it's becoming very chaotic. And the two key things that are preventing them from restarting are travel restrictions between provinces and also this self-quarantine measure for 14 days. There are lots of places that are requiring anyone coming in, not just from the epicenter of the virus outbreak of Hubei province, but anyone coming in, no matter where you are. And that takes away from businesses.
Sure. Last thing, and then I'll let you go. In your personal life, are they still, you know, checking your temperature when you walk in the building? Or are you still, you know, doing carry-out food because nobody else wants to go out? Is that still happening?
Oh, constantly. I'm getting my temperatures checked when I go into the shopping malls, into my residential area, if I go into the office building. Inside the office, we have to measure our own temperatures for sure. How accurate that is, I don't really know because the difference is so vast. In terms of takeout, there are more places to eat, of course, but I have to make sure that I make the cutoff because, as I said, a lot of them are closing quite early. Right. So I have to eat dinner by about 6 o'clock.
Jennifer Beck in Shanghai. Thank you, Jennifer.
Thanks, Kai.
On Wall Street today, there are a couple options for what happened. Traders truly believe the worst is past. That's one. This was a bounce of the dead cat variety is another. People saw the losses last week and decided today was a good day to get in. That's a third. Which one's right? Who knows? But I know this, even though I don't get to pick, it's going to be the happy music when we do the numbers. As I said a minute ago, companies are scrambling to figure out how to stay up and running if and when people can't come to the office anymore. I know we are. And that means working remotely is having a moment. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more on the challenges and the potential here.
New York real estate firm Squarefoot has started making emergency plans.
We just wanted to be prepared should the alarm bell really go off.
Head of HR Eugenie Fanning says she's asked employees to hold off booking business trips, to stay home for 2 weeks if they've traveled through affected areas, and to make sure they take home their laptops at the end of each day.
A lot of what we do can be done online.
JP Morgan has announced similar plans, while Nike temporarily shut its Oregon headquarters for cleaning over the weekend and asked employees with links to a COVID-19 case at a nearby school to stay home. Remote work has increased dramatically over the decades, says Sarah Sutton, the head of job listing site FlexJobs. But fully remote work still makes up only about 5% of full-time jobs in the U.S.
A lot of organizations are doing remote work right now in a very ad hoc manner. They don't have a formal plan in place.
That leaves many remote workers feeling isolated and unsupported. Callie Williams-Yost, a business strategist who helps companies implement flexible work arrangements, says COVID-19 could be a turning point.
I think this is an opportunity to become more intentional and strategic about making flexibility in the way work is done part of the cultural DNA.
Remote work allows companies to pull from a broader talent pool, lower real estate costs, and boost employee productivity, but does require additional training to make sure employees effectively communicate. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Jack Welch died yesterday, the longtime chairman and CEO of General Electric, one of the most celebrated executives of his day, was 84 years old. The legacy Welch leaves is complicated. It will be debated and case studied for years, in particular, the way he changed what American companies do. Profits above all, shareholder value first in line. Marketplace's Scott Tong has that one.
General Electric, once upon a time, explicitly served many masters: workers, research labs, and last of all, shareholders. That's according to company documents in the 50s. By 1981, in came a new boss, Jack Welch. He slashed underperforming divisions and workers. He spoke at MIT in 2006.
You bring him in, you say, look, this isn't working. You're in the bottom 10. You're not going to get any more money here. Let's, over the next year, get you to move on.
By then, cutting costs and pleasing shareholders was in vogue on Wall Street, and it worked for GE. Its stock way outperformed the market during the Welch decades of the 80s and 90s. Nicholas Heyman is longtime GE analyst at William Blair.
He had no problem redefining the landscape and what would work. And in that sense, you know, became kind of the Paul Bunyan of shareholder value creation.
Shareholder value often came at a cost to workers. It undid the post-war corporate social contract, says Rick Wortsman at the Drucker Institute. His book is The End of Loyalty.
GE had vaporized about 170,000 jobs under Welch. Up until that time, I don't think the term downsizing had really entered the American vernacular yet. These kind of huge mass layoffs were still seen as pretty scandalous.
When Welch stepped down in 2001, GE relied heavily on its finance arm, GE Capital, which Welch built up. And when the financial crisis came years later, the company got hit hard. Law professor Margaret Blair at Vanderbilt says that's when Welch's tone seemed to change.
As the company got into trouble, he conceded that maximizing share value is not always the smartest thing to do.
Do you think it suggests that he changed his mind over time?
He must have begun to see there were big problems in the underlying business.
Welch may have been onto something. Today, leading groups including the Business Roundtable, BlackRock, and the Davos World Economic Forum are rethinking the shareholders first model and its limitations. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up,
the outcome might have been different, and instead, they ended up back in jail, which, as everybody knows, is the most expensive solution to a social problem.
The parole officer's best tool sometimes is jail, but first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, really happy music. Dow Industrial's up 1,293 points, 5% closed at 26,703. The NASDAQ spiked 384 points, 4.4%. 89.52. The S&P 500 advanced 136 points, 4.6%, 3,090 there. Among the big gainers, Apple. It boosted 9.3% today after an analyst upgrade. Apple products and its strong balance sheet, the theory goes, would help it withstand uncertainty related to COVID-19. JD.com jumped 12.4%. That's a Chinese online retailer. Said it expects revenue to rise at least 10% in the first quarter and that it's benefiting from home deliveries as China, as Jennifer was talking about, works to contain the coronavirus. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 1.15%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. After 25 years, the gavel has come down on Judge Judy. Judy Sheindlin announced today she is going to be wrapping up her hit courtroom show next year. Sheindlin is one of the highest paid stars on television, getting, it is reported, $47 million a year, and her show is the most watched series in syndication. Now, syndication might not be familiar to those who've grown up in this world of streaming, so Marketplace Jasmine Garst explains how it works.
Tim Brennan is a big Judge Judy guy. He watches almost every day. He says there are a lot of court shows, but there's only one Judy.
She doesn't put up with any mess. Some of those other court shows are just kind of ridiculous.
Don't play cutesy with me. I don't like it.
Brennan watches her on Fox 6 in Milwaukee, but she's on the CBS station in L.A. That's because syndicated shows are sold station by station across the country. Meanwhile, a primetime show, like Survivor, only airs on CBS channels. David Lieberman teaches media management at the New School.
There are certain times of day that the networks don't control. They do control primetime, usually, but not daytime. And that's where the local station might say, we're willing to buy this show from you.
Making it to syndication, either reruns like Seinfeld or ongoing shows like Judge Judy, can be really lucrative. But the rise of streaming could change the model, says Tim Hanlon, a media analyst with Vertier Group.
A show like Judge Judy may actually be more attractive if packaged up and more directly accessible to consumers instead of having to go through the intermediary pipe, if you will, of a TV station. You could make the argument that the new syndication may actually be through streaming services.
Sheindlin says there will be reruns of Judge Judy, and she's starting a new show called Judy Justice. No word yet on where that will air. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
Thank you.
Paris Fashion Week wraps up this week, ending a month of regular runway shows in Europe and New York. Fashion people, I'll wager, won't necessarily be thrilled I'm pointing this out, but these shows are, on their face, symbols of consumption and excess at a time when businesses in a whole bunch of different industries are trying to be more sustainable. Rachel Cernansky wrote in Vogue about how the fashion industry is rethinking the runway. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
What should we make of the fact that here we are a couple of weeks into Fashion Month, as I gather it's now called, and climate change is becoming a thing? Have the fashion houses and designers kind of seen the light?
That's kind of still up in the air, but they have seen the light that people are caring. Yeah. That is for sure. And that there is sort of growing demand for more, quote unquote, sustainable fashion. But this story that I wrote about Fashion Weeks was really trying to sort of question the whole role of the fashion show.
Yeah, sure. One of the things I learned reading this piece is that Fashion Month is not just like New York Fashion Week and Milan Fashion Week and Paris Fashion Week. There's one in Copenhagen, there's one in Helsinki, and these shows, certainly Copenhagen and Helsinki, as you talk about, have sustainability goals, right? I mean, they are challenging designers and houses to meet their standards.
Mm-hmm. Helsinki has been doing it longer. Hmm. They have a comprehensive approach to how they do their fashion show, everything from, you know, energy efficient lighting to having everyone use public transportation to get to the show rather than all private vehicles and flights. But they also only show brands that have sustainable practices. But Copenhagen is a bigger fashion show, so it was kind of a big deal when they announced a few weeks ago that if brands want to continue showing there, they have to implement a set of criteria for how they produce their clothes, which is a big step from what the New York and other fashion shows do.
Well, I was going to say, because you read about and look at pictures of New York Fashion Week, and number one, it's all over Manhattan, right? So you're taking cars and black cars and all this stuff, and it's huge parties and a ginormous environmental footprint.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. It's an enormous footprint, but it's also just scratching the surface of the larger industry footprint.
Right. So that goes to the takeaway question, which is, it's great that Copenhagen and Helsinki are doing this, but is it going to matter until New York and Paris and Milan actually make this a priority?
That's a good question. There are some designers that are really trying to push the envelope. There's one in London, Patrick McDowell, who's featured in the story. He made a commitment to not design new clothes more than, I think it's once a year. Hmm. And he is restyling his collections for different shows, and he hosts more interactive events. And that sort of thing is interesting and getting people thinking about the more fundamental questions of the fashion show.
Well, right, because also if you're only designing new clothes once a year, that's a business model decision that you're making.
It is, and that's the point that he really drives home when you talk to him, because he's not depending on the wholesale model because he sells more directly. So it does pose these much larger business model questions for brands that sell to, you know, large retailers that do depend on this cycle.
Rachel Cernansky writing in Vogue Business about climate change and the fashion show. Totally fascinating piece. Rachel, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
One of the rare bipartisan moments in Washington the past couple of 3 years has been criminal justice reform. The First Step Act, it was called. Cuts to mandatory minimum sentencing was its big provision. A less well-known and less well-resourced part of the criminal justice system, though, is what we do, or more often don't do, when people get out of prison. Probation and parole. Jason Hardy was a parole officer in New Orleans when that state's incarceration rates were the highest in the country. He wrote about his life on the job and the resources he was given to do it in a new book called The Second Chance Club. Jason, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me how it was you came to be a parole officer in New Orleans, because it was a circuitous path, we should say.
It really was. I had spent most of my 20s kind of bouncing around from one profession to another. And I was 29, kind of working in retail and just sort of trying to find something with a little more meaning. And I was just kind of doing some reading on some things that were happening in the criminal justice system. And it just really sounded like a place where someone could really do some good if they got involved. So probation and parole was kind of the job that was available at the time. And so I kind of put my name in the hat and thought I'd go in and see what happened.
Tell me about the first day after you finished your training.
Well, the first day was a bit of a shock. I showed up and I was given 220 case files. Most were struggling with drug problems. Most had been poor for almost all their lives. And kind of the first question was, well, what tools do we have available to help these folks? Mm. And I learned in pretty short order that really the only tool we had was the jail. And that kind of the people who were the best at the job were people who kind of found end-arounds. Sometimes that's given a pep talk. Sometimes that's being a listening post. Sometimes it's letting something slide that, you know, might have gotten him locked up 10 years before. One good thing that was happening when I came aboard, the state was kind of slowly but surely coming around to this idea that locking people up was not really rehabilitating them. And so they were allowing us a little bit of latitude to kind of say, you know what, this isn't a big deal. Let's give this person another shot, kind of try something new with him.
It should be said here that with that latitude did not come extra resources or funding.
No. And that's one of the things that I really would like people to know about this system is that I think it has just tremendous potential in that, you know, when we did get resources and we could put them with the right people, we saw kind of amazing results. But they were so few and far between. I could name probably 50 or 100 people that I dealt with where if I just had the kind of right spot to put them, whether it was a detox or a rehab or just get them some professional counseling, the outcome might have been different. And instead, they ended up back in jail, which, as everybody knows, is the most expensive solution to a social problem.
Tell me, since you mentioned the people you dealt with, tell me about Sheila. Tell me her story.
Sheila was up against a lot. She was living with her mother who'd been fighting a crack addiction for about 20 years. She had dropped out of the 11th grade and wasn't really interested in going back in school. And she was actually on probation because she had flushed her boyfriend's drug stash down the toilet when the police showed up at her house. One of the things that really worked with Sheila, and this really came from just taking the time to talk to her and get to know her, was kind of figuring out, you know, counseling was going to go a long way. And as much as most of my fellow POs and I tried, we weren't trained counselors. And so with Sheila, it came down to getting her in a courtroom-administered program where she was able to meet with a licensed counselor.
You know, on this thing about your fellow POs, the guy you shared an office with, his name was Charles, right, if I remember right?
Yes, that's right.
There was a whole lot of learning you did from him that was not book learning. It was actually being out in the field and going into these houses or dealing with these people and figuring out in the moment how to handle them.
Absolutely. He's someone I'll be indebted to for the rest of my life. He's a true pro. He just could pick up on things that in the early going I really couldn't. You know, he could go into a house and, you know, he could speak with the family. He could kind of look around and he could say, you know, the grandfather is the person in this house who has the influence. That's the person whose side we've got to get on. And just always knew what question to ask to kind of get to the heart of the problem. And in a job where you have limited resources, those are really the skills you need. And he let me kind of beg, borrow, and steal from him and take all his tricks. But on my best days, I was never half as good as he was.
You know, it's well, not funny, but it's interesting that, you know, you talk about him in the epilogue and what he's doing now, and you mentioned he's been doing this for 20 years. And in the epilogue, you say he's counting down every last day of his 18 months till he can be done with this.
And it's not because he doesn't think it's been worthwhile. It's just because this work really takes its toll. And even the very best folks in this job have failures. They have people that they can't get to, they can't reach. And I, you know, I certainly think with more resources, we could do better, but there are cases where, you know, you do have the resources and the person you're trying to get them to just isn't quite ready. And I think that more than anything else is what kind of breaks your heart over time. Even the best people at the job still go home some days shaking their heads saying, why couldn't we do more?
Your heart broke, if I remember right from this book, in 4 years, 4 months and 18 days, and you had to do something else.
Well, maybe a little sooner than that, but I tried to carry on as best I could. But I got to the point where I felt like, frankly, sometimes I would fault people for things that weren't their fault. And that was kind of my warning sign that, you know what, maybe it's time for you to move on to something else.
It's a book called The Second Chance Club, Hardship and Hope After Prison. Jason Hardy wrote it. Jason, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
We've got an excerpt of Jason's book, the same place we always have him, online, marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, picking up where we left off on Friday, the caveat emptor part of stock picking. Remember, I mentioned the ticker symbol you want if you want to invest in the hot new video conferencing company Zoom is ZM, not ZOOM. Well, here's how good the last month has been for ZM. Bernstein Research says Zoom has added more users so far this year, 2.2 million active new users in 60-something days, than it did in all of 2019. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials 1,293 points to the good today, 5%. The NASDAQ up 384, that is 4.4%. The S&P 500 picked up 136 points, that is 4.6%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Andy Corbin, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Bennett Purser. Eliza Mills is our special projects producer. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.